and welcome to another Monday morning Book of Mormon class with Kevin Hinckley. Recorded live, we dive deeply and deliberately into this inspired scripture. How far we get in one class depends a lot on the material and the doctrines left for us by ancient prophets. A single chapter may occupy one class or many. Of course, opinions expressed by the teacher or the class members do not constitute official church doctrines. Join us in this adventure and discover the hidden treasure found within his pages. And now, on to the class. Let's go ahead and get going. Couple of things. Larry Lewis is just really wanting to be here, but his legs aren't cooperating. So I got a message from him early this morning. So our hearts go out to Larry because he's done so much research on this topic and is a member of the Genesis group and is good friends with Darius Gray. And so it'd be nice to have him here, but I know he's listening. So Larry, we miss you. Also, as we get looking at this, we're going to hit for at least a week before we dive back into older church history. We're going to dive into something that so many of us here remember. This for me is very emotional because I had some experiences around this. I found that as I was studying this again that I've kind of been emotional all week. Given the weight of what happened and how cool this is. But I do want to give a bit of a shout out. When you look at the 1978 revelation, there are two great sources that I was able to draw on. There's a number of others, but the first one was actually 1984. President Kimball's son, Edward, wrote a beautiful, long, detailed article from his dad's journal and gave us a lot of great information about what was happening kind of moment by moment. So we're going to have a real timeline that we're going to draw heavily on Edward Kimball's writings. And then also Paul Reeve, the church just published Race and the Priesthood. And we're now having, again, access to records and things that we've never had access to. And so, Brother Reeve, I think we had him here for a fireside a couple of years ago. And he's written and talked about extensively. So again, we have a lot of great information on this. Okay. And by the way, some have been asking for PowerPoints. I'm trying to figure out how to do a PowerPoint onto my text thing, and it's not going through. If you will email me, I'll be happy to send the whole slide because there's some great stuff here. Just at hinckleykevin@gmail.com, and I'll be happy to fire that along because there's a lot of good information here. Okay, all right. Well, let's go ahead and get rolling. Part of the problem with this one was not so much that I couldn't find information; I've got way too much. And trying to pick and choose what it is that the quotes and the experiences is tough. But let's go ahead and lean into this a bit. We're aware now that for a long time then, for a span from about for decades, the church was pretty settled in its history. Joseph F. Smith had forgotten that he had done extensive research into where the band started, and so that he was even in by 1907, he was saying the band started with Joseph Smith. And then it was settled doctrine. And so decade after decade saying, yeah, the band has always been here, this is the way it always is, and everybody just moved on that assumption. Joseph F. Smith, He'd done research in 30 years earlier to say, no, Joseph Smith didn't start it. This was Brigham Young. But then in 1901, as he's trying to doctrinize things. He says, no, this started with Joseph Smith. He'd kind of forgotten his own research.
So his own research actually...
30 years earlier.
Actually said that...
It started with Brigham Young. Yeah, because remember, he'd gone down to talk to Abraham Smoot in Provo, and Abraham Smoot had said, oh yeah, it started with Joseph Smith, and he came back and reported to John Taylor. He said, I don't think so. This doesn't ring true to me. And again, they had records then from like Elijah Abel saying, no, he ordained me, and here's my patriarchal blessing that says it. Here's my priesthood certificate to preach that says it. And even records of Jane Manning James saying, yeah, he was ordaining free black men. Was hesitant about slaves, but he was ordaining free black men. But we get this institutional memory lapse then that starts from the early 1900s until we get into about late 1940s, 1950, and now there's starting to be some questions because people are delving into this. And bless his heart, some of this had to do with Joseph Fielding Smith tended to be very protective about church records, and he was the church historian for 50 years. And so he was not open about opening up because that was his way of kind of protecting our history. So as President Kimball is coming into as an apostle, and later he's gonna tell Edward, and I thought this was interesting. He says, revelations will probably never come unless they are desired. I think few people receive revelations while lounging on the couch or playing cards or while relaxing. And then this, and you think about President Kimball's stature, this just makes me smile. I believe most revelations would come when a man is on his tiptoes, reaching as high as he can for something which he knows he needs, and then there bursts upon him the answer to his problems. Let that one sink in for a minute. Sometimes we get attacked in the church about, you know, what was the last revelation that we got, or how come? How come the bank failed in Kirtland? How come Zion never really happened? How come? You know, why didn't a prophet get a revelation to say we're doing the endowment and sealing wrong in the temple for many years? And we just expect that our prophets are going to be fax machines, and you know, if they're going to get this wrong, that an angel's going to show up and tell them to change it. But the process seems to be different than that. Why do you think that is? Why does the Lord operate this way? Yeah.
And the basis of this experience, this agency, and so we don't fully understand that. And that's why things don't happen. And
yeah.
That's why things are allowed to happen.
Yeah.
Because we don't understand the full impact of agency that everyone has to have.
And even agency for our leaders of the church.
Everybody. And it affects everybody. Nobody's alone.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And I cannot. The Lord will never allow me to be.
Until they play me.
Yeah. Yeah, I know, that was Scheide's problem. Well, but the question will then come back at you and say, but he's not going to let the church lead us astray, right? And but the prophets are going to make mistakes?
Oh, Lehi's vision of the Tree of Life.
Yeah.
He has the same vision that Nephi has. So I'm assuming that there's some kind of a, just like a video. Watch the same PowerPoint.
Hit replay, and we're just going to play it to him.
And he notices things, and he asks about things, and he's told, "Well, your father didn't notice that because of this." Or
that's true,
or
Mister.
Whatever, like that. And so they were given information when we're asking in faith, and in order to be asking in faith, we have to be ready to accept and embrace the revelation we get. But also, when I'm trying to solve a problem, once I think I have a solution, even if it's a horrible, wrong solution, I quit looking for an answer.
I'm invested in my...
And so,
yes.
If they're given guidance on what to do for the endowment, as soon as they think they have guidance, they're not asking any more questions. They're not
no.
to see whether or not...
Turns out they're human like us, really, here and then there. I like that. Yeah, and what it takes. Probably do. Yeah, I think that's true. Okay, yeah. Yeah.
So we think we don't know what we don't know. We fill in the gaps.
With our own knowledge or our what we want. We should.
I think I know everything I need to do, but I really don't.
Isn't it crazy that those that are the most certain about things are the ones that have the least knowledge? And we just double down on. Yes, but I really know this, so I don't have to look at anything else because I know this thing is. Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah. We're us.
Yeah, and we have the
yes.
The ark here. Thank you. I needed
that. Yeah, we're here. We're us, and you hear Laman and Lemuel saying that the Lord was not going to allow. So no, we are. Yeah.
But then to deepen that question, we still have things like Kirkland, and then Independence, and then all the plans.
And Zion Falls. Yes.
And these things were directed by the Lord.
Yeah.
They're not just an opinion of the prophet.
Yeah.
And yet they all failed.
Yeah.
And the apologetic answer for that is he was doing it to teach them. But I'm not sure.
I don't either.
I'm not sure of that answer.
No, and because we want to, that's why we want to kind of hide behind, well, the Lord was in all of it, and that's why they failed. So he asked him to do it knowing that they would fail in the first place, as opposed to not taking in all the factors that come into we follow, but then people get their agency. People get to choose. We get to choose what we're listening to. And I think this is one of those tension areas for us where we're having to say we believe in our own revelation and we believe in institutional revelation. And somewhere, sometimes we're leaning to one, sometimes we're leaning to the other. And sometimes we're a church that also loves certainty. I know with every fiber of my being. So to have to say, we don't know, it bothers us a bit.
Well, yesterday I was teaching a 17-year-old Sunday school class.
And it's amazing how much 17-year-olds know, right?
Going back to his standing on tiptoes, in Doctrine and Covenants, section 8, verse 3, it says, "Behold, this is the spirit of revelation. Behold, this is the spirit by which Moses brought the children of Israel through the Red Sea on dry ground." And we talked about the fact that, so what was his situation? He was being chased by the armies. He had the Red Sea. He was in a dire instance and needed revelation.
Yeah.
And it goes along with staying. you get in these situations where you have to have some guidance.
And you have to get stretched. And that's why I love that stretching on tiptoes means, you know, think about a little kid that wants a cookie on the counter. And it's just up on its tiptoe, it just wants that so bad. You know, we've got a black lab that, you know, paddling around in our kitchen. And then if I'm cooking meat, she's just with every part of her body. She's just, and I wonder if sometimes we want our answers that much. As much as a black lab wants a piece of meat or a child wants a cookie, do we really strain to get this? Yeah.
Well, I think about this black lab and that's the way that I seek my answers. If I decide what I want, and then I'm like, give it to me. I don't want a different answer.
And I know what I need. I know I need this. I certainly need this. I know best. I know me. Yeah, you had a... Yeah? Some of us were. Because they've always lived with the quality of this. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, especially if you're living in the South during that time. Yeah. Yeah. Good example. Good example. In fact, for Peter, remember, it's like, okay, I get the revelation, it works. And he's fine until he gets to Galatia. And then the Jews are pushing back, so he goes, well, maybe I won't eat with the Gentiles. And Paul rips on him. I can't believe you did that. And you don't get it. And so there comes in waves. So, all right, so let's do this. There are going to be a number of factors that lead us to President Kimball on his tiptoes, straining for an answer. And I want to go through some of the antecedents here. And again, a lot of this is not going to be brand new to anybody. But first of all, in late 50s and early 60s, President McKay is getting weird letters from Ghana. And one of them is talking about we need more materials. You need to come. We're missing some things. We have questions, and it's written on the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints Ghana branch. And President McKay turns to his counselor and goes, "Do we have a branch in Ghana?" "No, we don't." And they just keep coming. They keep coming. And so they're like, well, what do we do? Okay, so we're going to send Lamar Williams, who was one of the first presidency secretaries, say, would you please go down to Ghana and Nigeria and tell us what the heck is going on down there? So he sends back information, say, yeah, the first presidency is sending a representative to come down there. He gets to the airport. He walks out across the tarmac from the plane, and there are 10 pastors waiting for him. 10 LDS pastors who represent 15,000 people. 15,000 people, 10 pastors. And they're all going, come to mine, come to mine, come to mine, come to mine. And he has to choose one to go back to. And he's going to... back up here. The one that he chooses to go to, he explains for a long time about church policy and where they are, and he's trying to give them information because they wondered, are they just looking for welfare? Maybe they're just looking for kind of a handout, stuff like that. And then he says, okay, now do you have any questions? And Cindy, what was the question they asked? That's what they wanted to know. We've been reading and studying the Book of Mormon. We don't understand where Alma got his priesthood to baptize. And that was the moment he went, oh, these guys are serious. They are studying. They are hungering for this. And And he's going to go back to President McKay and go, these guys are legit. What do we do? Now, what's going to happen? There's going to be a civil war in Nigeria that is sometimes called the pause. And there's going to be several years now, about four, I think, where they don't have any contact with these guys because there's a civil war going on. Okay. Now, one of the people that really started this was a guy by the name of James Billy Johnson. Billy Johnson, I call the Paul of Africa, because Billy is like the first, and he will go around and he's reading and he's studying anything he can get. And then he's evangelizing and he's going out and he's setting up churches, and he was setting up house churches all over the place. And then other pastors were joining, and that's why there were 10 pastors covering 15,000 people, primarily because of Billy Johnson. At the time that he dies, he will be a patriarch in the stake. Okay, so we know that's going on, and that pressure's on. Okay, now what's happening in the 60s in the United States? We get the civil rights movement. Now, to give you some idea, and this is where President Kimball is very, very aware of what's going on. The Brethren were quite split on this. On one side, as the civil rights movement is happening, we have Isertap Benson, we got Harold B. Lee, we got Marky Peterson, Bruce R. McConkie, to name a few. And Isertap Benson's belief that the civil rights movement was about what? Communism. That this was how the civil rights movement was actually sponsored by the communists. And that was the driving force behind that, that it was going to destabilize the United States. And so it's a very kind of hard line, hard right kind of thing. On the other side of the aisle was people like Hubie Brown, N. Eldon Tanner, Marion D. Hanks, who were kind of much more progressive. Hubie Brown was very much in favor of saying something that he'd learned from President McKay. Because back when he was in the first presidency in the 50s, President McKay had come to believe, actually asking some of the Brethren to study this, the history that we did have access to. You had to be a member of the first presidency to get to some of this. And he said, I just don't think it started with Joseph Smith, and I don't think it's a doctrine. I think it's a... And then he frames this word, it's not a doctrine, it's a policy. Well, that's a shift in the way we're going to look at things. Because policies earlier than that were always doctrines. But he's going to say the church can have policies and the church can have doctrines and separate it out. So he's actually going to go to the rest of the 12 in 1954 and go, I think this is a policy, not a doctrine. And the Brethren will come back and say, it may be, but the people just aren't ready for this. They're not ready to make a change. And so But President McKay is still very sympathetic. Hubie Brown is actually, he's giving newspaper interviews where he's saying someday this is going to change. He's kind of pushing things a little bit. Yeah. With in 1954 is when they're saying that people aren't ready for it yet. But it still wasn't open because he's pushing behind the scenes, but President Brown is starting to agitate a little bit in the interviews that he's given. So you're starting to get this, the glacier is starting to move just a little bit, but it's still. But then we run into the civil rights movement where everything is out in front. These guys are still having to keep unanimous consent together in the 12, but they're underneath. They're working this. Okay, we're also having some things like Stanford refusing to play BYU. We're having the Molotov cocktails thrown at Colorado State out on the basketball court. Yeah, and we had the was there eight football players at Wyoming that refused to play, and they were kicked off the team. And we've made a lot of concessions in trying to meet with those people now. I mean, there's been some things that the church has done just in the last few years. But it was all agitating, and the church was under a lot of pressure at that point to do something about this. Okay? But there was still a split in what was going on with the quorum.
Your list on the left there is way too short.
Oh, absolutely. I know.
Two-thirds.
I think you're right. I believe that. But yeah, but I was just saying, these guys were primarily some of the pushers. I know Marion D. Hanks was really pushing behind there. No, member of the 70. Well, at that time, he was an assistant to the 12. Because they met, then the quorum of the 70 is going to play into this in just a second.
I wasn't a general authority, but a founder member of the church, George Romney, governor of Michigan, was also dead center.
He was. Yeah, he's pushing on that. You're right.
I came back from Michigan.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll talk about that in a sec. Okay. Hang on to that and then jump in, okay? Because if we're trying to talk about the elements that bring a flashpoint to needing to stand on our tiptoes and find out yes or no, finally from God, what he really wants us to do with this. So,
was it because they didn't have access to history, or were they sustaining the prophetic aspect of it, or was it racist?
No, from what I read, part of what happened is Ezra Taft Benson was so influential in the John Birch Society and everything that really did have kind of a caste system in mind, and it has its basis in kind of a Christian nationalism. That there was a lot of belief in the mark of Cain. That makes sense. There is a curse on these guys. There's a reason, and kind of white Europeans were. So is it kind of racist? Yeah, but it's kind of cultural. That is spurred into that. Okay.
When did Joseph Fielding Smith write Race and Priesthood?
That's in the 60s, wasn't it?
I don't know.
Yeah, I think it was.
Okay.
And then he's also doing Answers to Gospel Questions, where he's answering all that on a regular basis. Go get that book.
So,
yeah.
These brethren didn't think that Acts 10 and 11 had anything to do with the truth?
No, these guys are saying that's there, but it really doesn't apply. But they're gonna get the priesthood. They're going to get the priesthood, but only after all of Adam's race. Everybody else gets it, and then they will get it sometime in the eternities.
Yeah, but
I know.
Acts,
I know.
Back
hold on to that idea, because President Kimball is going to keep sending people into the scriptures. I need verification where this is coming from. Now, I want to mention one other thing in conjunction with this, okay? Who was the president of the church prior to Spencer Kimball? Who was the prophet of the church after Spencer Kimball? That's why it is that President Kimball at some point is going to say, I needed to do this, because if it wasn't me, I'm not sure whether it would ever happen. He knew that he was in a unique spot, and he alone, when he becomes prophet, he knows now whatever he was sustaining the brethren before, but now it falls on him to get the answers to what we're doing here, regardless of what we might think, regardless of what culture is saying. I know where President Lee was, and I know where President Benson is. If it's to be, it's up to me to get the answer. So,
if it hadn't happened, can you imagine the horror show that the church would have?
It gotten worse and worse. And I who's to say that, you know, Ezra Taft Benson never did turn out to be the ironclad, you know, he in his work with the Book of Mormon and everything, he was not the the fear that a lot of people worried about. He was a tremendous prophet, okay? And could he have got it? Might have. But President Kimball was convinced that based on kind of where they are, if there's an answer, this is the moment in time, and it's got to be me.
Doesn't that kind of torpedo the whole concept of the Lord will take him away from his place if he's going to mislead people or not?
A little bit, but at the same time, he's having to say, I need to recognize that people have their own opinions. So what else is going to happen here? Ah, well, it's going to be Brazil. Now, as I've been thinking about this, I think this is fascinating. Brazil, President Kimball then announces in 1977, we're going to build a temple in Brazil. Now, what were they finding in Brazil? Yeah, and not only that, they had adopted what was actually coming out of years earlier in Virginia when they were trying to determine who was black and who wasn't. They developed what they called the one-drop policy. If there's one drop, they're black. And so sometimes, and so when in Brazil, when they're trying to say one drop, well, now they got a problem. But President Kimball, you think it's an accident that President Kimball says, let's announce a temple in Sao Paulo. No, holy mackerel. And keep in mind here, this is 77. The temple is going to be dedicated in October of 78. When does the revelation come? June 78. Yeah, temple's almost done. Now, I think so. Here, I think is part of the genius of what he's doing here. Okay, and I wish Steve Richards was in town because he's gonna do a significant baptism on his mission.
One drop of blood comment reminded me of something that said last week about. What about the issue of everybody coming from Adam?
Yeah.
And I'm not, I had to think that through. What did that person do? That's what the teacher did.
Yeah, what it means and what they were teaching is that it's almost like the entire human race has to, because of what Cain did, those that descend from Cain, they will be the last ones to get the priesthood, but everybody else has to get it first. Because Cain came from Adam and Eve.
Okay. I thought that the point was that means that all the races came from Adam and Eve. Well, then we all. I mean,
well, if you're taking the Bible literally, which they did back then, say, yeah, they did. And because of that, everybody else has to get it first. Go to the back of the bus. One of these days you'll get it.
So I'm the one who made the comment.
It would be you, yeah.
You know, if God wanted to change the color of people's skin and have their children's skin color and their children's skin color all be changed, he would just change your DNA.
Yeah.
He's not going to say, okay, well, we're just going to magically make it. And he controls our DNA. So, I mean, as much as I find it preposterous that Joseph Smith thought that if you accept the gospel and you're
your DNA will change. Yeah.
The thing is that's the easiest way for God to do it.
Yeah.
To make all these different races.
I know. I know. But when you're taking a very literalist approach, people can't get past this thing. Yeah.
I think that's how this works. You move forward.
Yes.
Was a massive show. It was a massive church, right? Institutional revelation. That we are supposed to go through every day. You step in faith.
Right.
You take those steps.
Yeah.
And on your tiptoes.
On your tiptoes. But remember, primarily, who did President Kimball have to move first? The Quorum of the 12. Yeah. White guys. Yeah. Yeah, he was a senior.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So
yeah, hold on. I'm going to show you that in a sec. But it, I know, but even into this process, again, well, hold on. I'm going to answer that because we get some nice statements here in just a sec.
My secret imagination that I don't talk to anybody about, I think that it has more to do with adaptation, like where the tribe settled and ended up. You know, I mean, I like to think that if I took my friend's daughters and my sons and went somewhere by the equator, that
you'd end up darker.
In 1500 years,
a little darker, yeah.
Just where they are.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if I'm crazy to think that. But
okay, Brett.
I teach DNA and genealogy, and they know that fish that grow that live in caves lose their eyesight.
Yeah, I've heard where rattlesnakes were on a boat that went to an island where they had no predators, and the first generation was born without rattles. You know, I mean, because they didn't need them.
Well, there you go.
So
there you
I'm
go. Okay. Okay, Brent.
My friend that served in the Gulf, the thing that he told me, look at this. What they ran into when he knew that state president.
Yeah. Yes. It's true. That's right. Yes.
But he found that out.
Yeah, that's true.
And that was happening quite commonly. Didn't know.
Until they did it. Yeah, now go do your genealogy. Oh, crap. No, no. Okay. Now, again, Steve Richards, who lives in the Round Rock ward, a good friend of mine, he's out. They're out tracting. They tracked up a man by the name of Hervecchio Martins. Okay. Steve was in town. I was going to have him here. Hervecchio Martins is called as but he's faithful. He's active. He's involved. He's got a lot of black ancestry. But they call him as communications director there in Sao Paulo. Okay, and so when they announce the temple in Sao Paulo, he's involved a lot in getting information out to the press and stuff like that. So he's very involved in that. Okay. As Hervecchio Martins waited at the cornerstone ceremony to begin, remember they used to have the groundbreaking and then they'd have a cornerstone ceremony separate a little bit later. Okay. At the cornerstone ceremony to begin, he glanced at President Kimball, who was there. He was sitting on a small stage next to the temple walls. The prophet seemed to be motioning to him, but Hervecchio wasn't sure. He saw President Kimball whisper something to James E. Faust, a newly called member of the Quorum of the 70, who had served a mission to Brazil during the 1940s. Elder Faust looked at Hervecchio and said, "Come here, I want to talk to you." Remember, this is October 77. Hervecchio quickly excused himself, made his way to the stage. As he approached, President Kimball stood up and hugged him. Then put his arm around and looked at him and said, "Brother, the watchword for you is faithfulness. Remain faithful and you will enjoy all the blessings of the gospel." Wow. What is not being said here is that Brother Martins, who became Elder Martins, first black general authority, had already started a mission fund for his son.
Marcus Martin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's his son, I think.
Right. We were in BYU Hawaii.
Yeah, that's his son. Very cool. That's nice. Yeah. Yeah, and that was the mission fund that he'd started for Marcus.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. So October 1977, and that's just, and that was just, and he didn't know, he didn't understand why. What's going on here? But he was going to cling to that promise. But that means the temple is already building, and it's a year away from dedication. Okay. Now, this is where it starts at LeGrand Richards. He says, down in Brazil, there's so much Negro blood in the population, he explained. It's hard to get leaders that don't have Negro blood in them. We just built a temple down there. It's going to be dedicated in October. All those people with Negro blood in them that have been raising money to build the temple, if we don't change, they can't even use it. I mean, it's kind of like lights are coming on here. We got to do something here, okay? So there is a sense that they're kind of, like I say, I think President Kimball is very carefully moving the leadership of the church, and that's moving the church membership along and just presenting them with opportunities. Because I think he could have said, we're not building any temples in Brazil. I think the temple in Brazil was a shot across the bow to force a decision one way or the other. What are we doing on this?
So, knowing that the brethren are faithful and they believe in Revelation, why didn't he just say, why did he feel like he had to move them and not just say, I've received a revelation in the black?
Hang on to that. We're getting there. Yeah.
One other thought. I worked with one young man that we talked about told us, he said, look, you don't understand. You're the Roman Empire. A lot of slaves came in the world.
Yeah. 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 So again, and again, we're going to get them to do their genealogy, and guess what we're going to start finding? Right.
So men need the priest to go to the temple. How about women?
They're still marked with the curse of Cain. They couldn't go either. Remember, if you're a black female back then, you couldn't go to the temple either. No. Well, there was a lot of things going on, but remember, that was Jane Manning James still saying, can I at least go into the temple and get sealed? Because Emma Smith wanted me to do it. She couldn't go either. They made up a ceremony for her where she was ceremoniously being sealed as a servant.
As an adopted daughter.
Yeah, some weird thing. Anyway. All right, so it's happening. Now, so I want to start. So what I thought I would do is, as we get closer here, President Kimball has asked then three apostles to actually research the scriptures hard and see if this really does match what we know. And I know that it's Bruce R. McConkie, Boyd K. Packer, and there's one other brother, and I keep forgetting who that was. But anyway, Elder McConkie does a big search on it, and he comes back and goes, I can't find it. This isn't scriptural. And I think he's trying to move some of the more conservative members of the Quorum of the Twelve to say, take a hard look at this. It's not there. If you're black, you can't enter the temple. Right. You're still the mark of Cain, so you can't. That was doctrine that they then saw as policy, but they couldn't find it in the scriptures. That's why this whole thing starts to move. Oh, it doesn't exist. That they were doing that? Yes. Joseph Fielding Smith said, or Joseph F. Smith says, if there's one drop of Negro blood, you can't go to the temple, male or female. It is, it is. Because in the early 1900s, he was trying to standardize doctrine on a variety of things. Word of wisdom, blacks in the priesthood, plural marriage. And one of them was this. So that's why it's a problem. Okay, so now, let's get down to it. Now, there's a very understated thing that's going to happen here that isn't really talked about much, but privately a number of the brethren said this was huge. And that was in 1973, an amateur historian by the name of Lester Bush, writes this article in Dialogue, which was Eugene England's kind of progressive magazine that he was publishing. Lester Bush is going to write this article. He's got extensive research, and he's going to say, it started with Brigham Young. It didn't start with Joseph Smith, and he's got a lot more detail. And the Brethren will say, this article was being quietly passed around the Brethren, and that President Kimball had read it and was touched by it. It made sense, and it was well documented. Okay, so that's why I say it's very quiet, but Lester Bush needs a shout out in terms of being one of those factors that led to kind of what happens next. This is 1973. Uh-huh. Yeah, he was actually a plumber? No, he was a physician. He was a physician. Physician.
About the same.
Yeah, depending on which branch you go to. Yes. Okay. All right. So anyway, that's Lester Bush. So I want to make sure that we keep in mind. Okay. So, all right. So now let's kind of do a little countdown here, because I had to go back through this a number of times so that I made sure that I had my timeline down, because I think the timeline is kind of cool. President Kimball, day after day, especially on Saturdays, this is just as we're coming into 1978. Day after day, especially on Saturdays and Sundays when there were no sessions in the temple, I went there where I could be alone. I was very humble. I was searching for this. I wanted to be sure. Anybody here ever go to the old mission home in Salt Lake? Okay, few. The old mission home across from the church office building. Okay, and as missionaries, what would happen? There was like I was there for a whole week. Okay, and at one point, what happened is they marched everybody out of the old mission home through the church office building, down the stairs, and then there's this long kind of greenish hallway to get you up into the temple underneath the street, right? And all the way at the end was, there'd be like a little temple recommend person there, okay? For years, my aunt was that person. So she got, and during this period of time, she's there. She's there. And she told us later that she kept seeing President Kimball come down this long hallway, and she'd look at his recommend, recognize, okay, but she says, but it was daily, and she at that point she was going, something's up, what is going on with President Kimball? Because he's working on something, but she had no idea what it was, okay, and so she was thrilled when she found out. He says, I had a great deal to fight. Myself largely because I'd grown up with this thought that Negroes should not have the priesthood, and I was prepared to go all the rest of my life until my death and fight for it and defend it as it was. Okay? I'm going to support the Brethren. I'm there. They're saying it shouldn't happen. I will defend that. Okay? All right. Now, at one point, he comes off a flight in February, And he doesn't even go home. He just has his driver take him directly to the temple. He has his own set of keys. He lets himself in. There's nobody there. He goes up and he goes to the Holy Holies to immediately continue praying because he's struggling with this. There is another moment while he's doing this that I read where somebody coming in to change out the fire alarm system. And they walked in on him, and then he was really embarrassed. He'd walked in on President Kimball, so he steps out, and it was not long after that President Kimball found that they were putting a guard outside the Holy of Holies to make sure that he was, because there was a sense people knew that he was there constantly. He was working on something. Nobody has any idea what it is that he's working on, but it was very well known. Okay, now. So let me give you the timeline on this then. So what's going to happen now as we get close to it? March 9th, President Kimball now believes that he has enough of an impression and an understanding that this needs to change. I think he's had it for a while. Certainly he had it in October. but he's getting that answer, and he knows that it's there, and now he's going to explain to the 12, I think we need to change this. And I'm about ready to change this. What do you guys think? And the Quorum of the 12 is going to say, we could support you, but because this has been in place for so long, there's going to have to be a revelation. Yeah, because if it's just simply changing a policy, that's not going to fly very much with them. And for some in the Quorum of the 12 and members of the Quorum of the 70, this was going to almost be a bridge too far. The struggle. So if this big, there has to be a revelation attached to this. And he goes, okay, got it. And so he then leaves. Now he's going to come back then. This is March 9th. And keep in mind, the revelation to the 12 is going to be on June 1st. So I want you to see what's advancing here timeline-wise. March 23rd, he tells his counselor he is now impressed to make a change. This is just to the first presidency. We need to change this. So I'm not just thinking about it. We need to change this. And his counselors, and Eldon Tanner, Marion G. Romney, said, if you want to make the change, we'll support you. We are now, so now the first presidency was on board. This is 78, okay? This is just weeks before it happens, okay? I'm impressed to make the change, okay? April 20th, he now asks the 12 to begin to fast and pray, should we be changing this? But he's not telling them that he's already told the first presidency that he's going to make a change. So he's now asking the 12 to enter it fasting and praying.
Their job to research
it. It is. And he's really, I need you guys to, by your own research, to come to know what I know. So that in each individual, and I just think this is President Kimball's masterful, moving a very difficult situation with very dogmatic people, that if their dogmaticism moves in our direction, they're really powerful. But right now I've got strong headwinds. I've got to get them to move to the right direction. Okay. Now, so that's April 20th. Now, another interesting little thing happens. Remember at a meeting of the Quorum of the 12 on May 4th, this is May 5th, so we're right on top of it, we get LeGrand Richards' vision. What's the vision? Here's what he's going to say. I saw during the meeting a man seated in the chair above the organ, bearded and dressed in white, having the appearance of Wilford Woodruff. I'm not a visionary man. This was not imagination. It might be I was privileged to see him because I'm the only one here who had seen President Woodruff in person. I'm the only one that would recognize that's who it is. Now, why Wilford Woodruff? What had Wilford Woodruff presided over? Plural marriage, the change in plural marriage. The last major change of this caliber, right? So he's going to see that in vision, and he's hesitant to tell anybody about what he's just seen, but he records it in his journal that it's there, it's happening. Okay, now, so timeline continues. Now May 25th. So this is May 4th. Whoops. They're in the meeting. He looks up. Sitting up there in a chair, he sees Wilford Woodruff sitting there. There's no talk, there's nothing, nothing. He just goes, wow.
So why did he tie that then?
Such a monumental.
Yeah, and so here's Wilford Woodruff sitting in going, the last time they made a change, it's interesting that he's sitting in on it, and he's just like, well, that's... Because at the time, I don't think he knew then. He just knew we're struggling with this issue, and here's Wilford Woodruff listening in. Okay. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably. Yeah. Yeah, because if you even look at his book, he would have been one of those that needed to move. Yeah.
And no one else could see him. So
he's going to say, that's what I saw. Okay, now, May 25th, he asked Marky Peterson, another fairly entrenched dogmatic. I remember Elder Peterson had come to our mission a year before. Wonderful man, loved him. But he was very strong on certain things. And he's asking Marky Peterson now for scriptural justification. And Marky Peterson then comes back and says, I can't find anything. There's nothing here. No justification for it. Okay. All right. So May 30th, he then sits down and he writes out a handwritten statement. If we were going to write something to the world, if we were going to make a statement to the church, what would it sound like? And in President Kimball, in his own handwriting, just writes out this handwritten statement. And he's going to give it to his counselors. Then they're going to ask G. Homer Durham, who is a secretary at that point, will help clean it up a little bit and get it to where they want it. But he's got that. Okay, so now he's all set. May 30th. That's Tuesday. On Thursday, June 1st, it's kind of D-Day, or R-Day, I guess you want to call it. The Quorum of the Twelve, First Presidency, have their regular Thursday meeting. They always would come fasting, and they meet in the Holy of Holies. Or no, they can meet not in the Holy of Holies. There's a high council or
assembly.
Yeah, and they're meeting there, and it's got an altar. True. Okay. So they meet for 3.5 hours, and then on regular church business. Okay, they get done. Two of the brethren have got meetings and places they need to go, so they get up and they leave to go down to the dressing room and change out of their temple clothes. And then President Kimball says this, brethren, I canceled lunch for today. Would you be willing to remain in the temple with us? I would like you to continue to fast with me. I have been going to the temple almost daily for weeks now, sometimes for hours, entreating the Lord for a clear answer. I have not been determined in advance what the answer should be. And by the way, will you go get the other two brethren and tell them to come back? Well, this is just the Quorum of the Twelve.
No, I mean,
at that moment, probably about 8 million, 7, 8 million, okay? I will be satisfied with a simple yes or no. But I want to know, whatever the Lord's decision is, I will defend it to the limits of my strength, even to death. But we got to have an answer now. Okay? So then, what's going to happen here is that then they're all settled, and then President Kimball will do an amazing thing. He said, would it be okay if I led us in prayer? Would it be okay if I led us in prayer? Yes. And they actually, and he kneels at the altar. They form a prayer circle around him. And the brethren said the Lord seemed to just take over. And he pleads with the Lord in that setting, in a prayer circle setting, kneeling at the altar. Okay, now. Elder McConkie, well, there's a number of quotes. I just chose a couple of these. Elder McConkie. It was though another day of Pentecost had come. On the day of Pentecost in the old world, it's recorded that cloven tongues of fire rested upon the people. They were trying to put into words what is impossible to express directly. There are no words to describe the sensation, but simultaneously the 12 and the three members of the First Presidency had the Holy Ghost descend upon them, and they knew that God had manifested his will. I had had some remarkable spiritual experiences before, particularly in connection with my call as an apostle, but nothing of this magnitude. All of the brethren knew at once knew and felt in their souls what the answer to the importuning petition of President Kimball was. Some of the brethren were weeping. All were sober and somewhat overcome. Howard W. Hunter was next to President Kimball as he's kneeling there. And as soon as President Kimball stands up, they immediately grab each other and hug, and they're both weeping. Just powerful, powerful. When President Kimball stood up, several of the brethren turned, threw their arms around him, and wept. And they all have kind of this likewise experience that they're just vibrating with. Okay. Marion G. Romney, his counselor. Brethren, I have a confession to make. I knew President Kimball was searching for an answer, and whenever we discussed the question, I told him, if you get an answer, I'll support you with all my strength. But I did not expect him to get an answer. Very, very frank. If the decision had been left to me, I would have felt that we'd always had that policy and we would stick to it no matter what the opposition. I resisted the change in my feelings, but I came to accept it slowly. Now I have changed my position 180 degrees. I am not just a supporter of this decision, I am an advocate. When the revelation came, I knew the mind and will of the Lord had been made manifest. So all of these months of preparing, President Kimball had been preparing their minds for it. He was out in front of this, but he was able to get them to that point where their hearts were open, and they were all, and then they were able to have this magnificent experience together. Okay. One of the things that will now happen is that there will be a question of how and when do we announce this to the church, and. Somebody had suggested that there's a mission president conference coming up in July. And Elder McConkie said, no, if we wait too long, the devil will interfere. He's going to make it look like we did this by an expediency, like we were being forced into this. We've got to announce it right away. President Kimball still had another concern. And that was, I now have the first presidency, the Quorum of the Twelve have had this experience. Who else do I need to get a buy-in from? The other general authorities. They had recently shifted all of the Quorum of the assistants to the Twelve to the Quorum of 70. And the first Quorum of 70 met on Thursdays in the assembly hall. Or assembly room in the Salt Lake Temple. Their meeting was that following Thursday. That would be on the 8th. And so President Kimball said, we're not willing to renounce this to the world now until I get their buy-in. He's still deathly afraid. I guess looking at our history, what happens when the general authorities are kind of fighting among themselves? So I need to have their 100% buy-in. And if I get one dissenter, I'm going to hold off. And he was willing to do that with the 12. Okay. So what's going to happen here? On Thursday, he presents the changes. They write it up. They clean up the thing that they now want to give out as a press release. In the morning, he gives that to the Quorum of the 12. They unanimously support it. Now we've got the afternoon meeting of the Quorum of the 70, and they're all going to be there. And a number of them have, I mean, so they meet on Thursday, and then a lot of them would have like state conference assignments around the world. They're going to leave on Friday. Okay. So this is Thursday. So he's going to put out the word. So call a meeting of the Quorum of the 70, but tell them, cancel your travel plans. I want everybody here on Thursday afternoon. Okay. All right. So cancel your travel plans. Thursday afternoon, I think this is interesting. A lot of fun little things going on here. On Thursday, Brother Woolsey, who is the church public relations director, goes home sick. So he doesn't. He calls in sick on Thursday morning, June 8th. And he's going to go, you need to come back. Oh, that's right. I forget. So the meeting, come back. The Corpsman of the 70 is going to come back for Friday morning. Sometimes I get this mixed up. So tell the Corpsman of the 70 that's just met, we have another meeting coming on Friday morning. I apologize for the timeline, but I think it's kind of cool. So they met, they get done. Now they get word, there's another meeting tomorrow morning. What? Really? Okay. Thursday afternoon, Elder Monson is going to call Brother Woolsey, who's homesick, and say, you need to come back in. Oh, I'm sick. I know. Come in anyway. So Brother Woolsey's going to come in Thursday afternoon, and he gives him the press release that's going to go out on Friday morning after the meeting of the Quorum of the 70. Oh. And he just loses it. But he's got to sit on this great secret. Okay. Elder Thomas Monson also calls the Deseret News. Hold the presses on Friday. There's a big announcement coming. And the director of the Deseret News says, well, is this, should I put it on like page B? Should it be on A, below the fold? Where, and he goes, you'll know it when you see it. Really? You'll know it when you see it. Okay. Friday morning, that morning, President Tanner is going to call KSL Radio. There is an announcement coming. Stand by. What is it? You'll know it when you hear it. But I'm going to be, I will be calling you in a few minutes. Woolsey. Uh-huh. Yes. Oh, no, he reads it and he weeps. He just over, and I'll share that in a second. Positive. Positive. Okay, so again, President Tanner has told KSL Radio to get ready. There's an announcement coming. Stand by.
So they're telling all these people, we're going to have an announcement.
Right.
We haven't had the meeting with the 70
right.
yet, but President Kimball has said, we're not going to do it if there's one person who doesn't.
So there might not, they might have had to call that off and just say, okay, we're not going to do it if, because I got to have 100% buy-in.
Okay.
But we think it's going to happen, so get them ready, because we want to have this smoothly. We want it to come from us, not from the ground roots and not rumors and stuff like that, okay? All right, so here comes the response. Well, what's going to happen is that they will then file in Neil Maxwell and Paul Dunn and others. Marion D. Hanks have all written about the fact that they went into that meeting not knowing what this was going to be. Not a clue. But as soon as President Kimball started to talk, they went, oh, it's this. Oh, my gosh. And they were just shocked and thrilled. Okay? They're going to say, all right. One of the brethren is going to say, I would have voted against this proposal until I experienced the feeling that I did in this room this morning. Each of them verbally endorsed the proposal. Elder Hanks, nearly overcome with emotion, says, thank God I have lived long enough to see this day. A vote approved the decision unanimously. Okay? I love this. This is my favorite part. Spencer puts his hand on President Tanner's knee and says, Eldon, go tell the world. Eldon, go tell the world. President Tanner left to deliver the message to Heber Woolsey, directing manager of public relations, who was standing by. President Tanner returned in a few minutes and said, it's done. Friday morning, Heber Woolsey waited on the announcement. President Tanner told him to expect. When Heber had received a copy of the announcement, he read it over. He wept. President Tanner said, you're not the first to shed tears, and instructed him to release the statement.
So Woolsey didn't know the subject until...
Not right. Yeah, just get ready. There's going to be an announcement. So So one of the things that for me I remember, and I think this is what I've got. Yeah. On that morning, on February 9th or June 9th, I'd started to date a girl in my home, well, not Cindy, before I went to BYU. Yeah. And I thought a really good PR move on my part would be to go golfing with her dad. So her dad and I went golfing on Friday morning, in the morning, and we went golfing. We had a great time. We got back. I dropped him off at home, and then I drove up to my house. And then I saw the weirdest thing. As I'm driving up the road, I see my mom running down the sidewalk. I went, what the heck? Because my mom was not into exercise in any way, shape, or form. She was not. That was not her thing. But she is literally running. And I pulled off to the side of the road, and I rolled down the window, and I went, Mom, what are you doing? And she goes, they've given blacks the priesthood. They've given blacks the priesthood. You know. Now, I was a recently returned missionary. I'd been back 90 days. And I said, Mom, that's not going to happen in this lifetime. I know what I understand. She's like, no, it's happened. It's happened. They're making announcements on the radio and TV. And I said, Mom, get in the car. Yes. As a missionary, my mom's gone crazy. She's heard something. I don't know. Okay. She was running. She had a friend that lived like just down the street, and she was running to tell her. No. I'm like one of the apostles going, oh, the women are saying this. It's just no good. Okay. Friday morning. Okay. Now, at that moment, apparently, let's go back to Salt Lake. One of the religion reporters for KSL was a man by the name of Dwayne Cardall, and he did that for years and years and years. Okay, he has heard that there's a big announcement. He drives over to the church office building in one of the big microwave truck things to find out what's going on. He gets a copy of this thing and he can't even get back to KSL with it. He just kind of pulls off to the side. We're going live. Right now. We got to go right now. Okay. Pulls off the side, set up the camera, and he's standing there and he starts reading this announcement over and over. And the long awaited day has come. He's going down there. That is about the time I hauled my mom into the house and we turned on the TV. And I see Dwayne Cardall making this announcement. And I was blown away. I was blown away because D, like you had, I'd just come home from my mission. I'd spent my last Christmas day with a black family that I loved. And then we lost them when I had to explain that they would never get the priesthood. And it had just killed me. And I'd been heard about it for months. And so in June to suddenly get this, it just buckled my knees. And then we just sat all day watching the news reports roll in, and CBS News led with it, you know, and every major news outlet in the country was leading with the fact that the Mormons had done this. And I remember that night, I was working all night at 7-Eleven, so about 10 o'clock at night, I'm on my way up, driving to Ogden, to my 7-Eleven, my shift, and I'm listening on the radio again, and I'm just kind of praying as I'm driving, and I had such a powerful hit spiritually, just say, this is right, and it's inspired, and this is amazing. And I wept while I drove. I was just overcome by the whole thing. Okay? And I just know that in the days that followed, suddenly these amazing things started to happen. Then they dedicated a temple in Sao Paulo, and all the people that had helped construct it and build it and contribute to it could now actually attend along the way. I don't know what, so that was my reaction. I don't know what you guys.
You know, I remember hearing it, and I've heard that people, that there were some people that were very, that were disturbed about it.
Yeah.
I've never known one of them or ever heard of one of them. And I think the church received this news with absolutely pure joy.
Ecstasy. Yeah, I think so too. I don't know, anybody else have any experiences? Younger.
I was nine.
Just a baby.
And apparently I didn't pay a lot of attention to it. And so I remember exactly, I remember it was Washington. I remember the building. I remember walking in. I remember hearing it. I remember because I sat and I saw a black man who was in our building. And my heart hurt for something the church had done. So it actually had sat in my mind as a problem, right? One of those things you deal with. Where that's how my response was, because I think up to that point, it had never, I mean, this is how I was raised, it had never crossed my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Something that harmful in my mind would have come from the church. So to sit in the church building, have heard that, and see a black man building
and go,
what? It's been very interesting to see. That's always said in the back of my mind.
Yeah.
As a 9-year-old, you know, when you're very emotionally impressionable, that's how experiences are remembered.
It's true. It's true.
So for me, it was remembered as, oh, you did what?
I didn't know we were not doing that. At 9, you didn't know. Everybody gets to go to the temple. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So long.
We did.
And we get forgiven. And I just say that we're in now. This wrong place that we have a wonderful spiritual eye. Have we transformed that to real in America? We have a lot of black, maybe Brazil and Africa.
Yeah.
So how does that really translate into real reality? So I think it needs to be, I think more than what we've been doing.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons I've been so appreciative of the work, for instance, that President Nelson is doing with the National NAACP. Certainly here in Plano, we're kind of going out of our way to, and we're working closely with the NAACP in Plano. And we keep having, and help, they've got a school that we're helping support. So on the ground, there are a lot of things that we still need to do. I agree with that. But I also think that there's a lot of ground that we can make up to kind of turn around some of the perceptions. Yeah. Oh yeah, we're chasing them, a lot of them, because I just think about the faith of 15,000 Africans without the priesthood, without any support from Salt Lake, that just see it, understand it, organize it. In fact, have you ever seen the pictures of that church in Ghana? They had carved angel Moroni, about an 8-foot angel Moroni, painted it in gold, and put it right in front of the pulpit in their chapel. You know, that was their. In fact, I think you can go to the church museum these days and see that. Yeah.
Well, I guess when Cindy and I arrived in Africa,
the DRC,
and I think we went thinking that we were going to, well, it was definitely a third world country, but a lot compatible living conditions. But the quality of the leadership, the quality of the sacrament meetings, and the talks given in the sacrament meeting, and if you've ever been in, well, I know black congregations here sing differently, but I'll tell you, you have never heard singing like in the
no question.
Congregations.
I know. That's one of the reasons why I kept hoping, you know, as the church is making changes in the hymn book, that they're going to be able to nod more to local music there should be drums, right?
They just take the standard hymns, but they sing.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. Yeah, we're a little. That's why I remember Gladys Knight's conversation with President Hinckley, where she meets him and he says, "I hear you don't like our music that much." Gladys Knight, I just think it could use some updating. Alan, you were. Yeah, we're better off not doing it. Yeah.
but there was a banquet, and I was standing on the street on the temple. So the temple's, you know, to the south of the parking lot is to the north. I'm standing there, and there was these long tables. You know, the church had set up all these long tables. They were covered with food, and there was all these people there. And I was there, and my brother, who also heard it, was there. One of his friends, who didn't accept the gospel, was there with me as well. He was a Japanese guy who was a Buddhist. Okay, so we're sitting, we're here, there's 1,000 people milling about. I look up in the sky, and the sky turns red. And like a big thunderstorm, middle of the best sunset ever. I mean, it's bright red, brilliant, and it starts to swirl around, and the people who were there at this banquet were in a panic, and they're running all different directions, and they're all scared, and I could hear them saying, "It's the second coming, right? Here it comes right now," and my brother grabs me by the hand, says, "This is not the second coming," and starts pulling me away, and as he's pulling me away, this trailer comes swirling out of the sky like the Wizard of Oz. And it was one of these trailers like you'd see at the grocery store selling tacos, or hot dogs, you know, with the flip-up arm. And this thing came down, swirled around, and landed on the street landed on Main Street, where now the park is, right? But at the time, it was still a street. Landed on Main Street between the temple and the church office building. As my brother is dragging me to the corner parking lot, which is on the northeast corner, there used to be a parking lot there too, as he's dragging me there, I can see President Kimball walking toward this trailer. And the trailer thing opens up, and there's a black guy inside the trailer. And he's wearing a red and white striped suit, like he's from the carnival, with a boat hat that goes with the suit. And I don't know what they were saying, but President Kimball was shaking the guy's hand. And so that was pretty much the end of the dream. I woke up. And in the morning in the mornings at my house, if anybody had a really cool dream, we would share and talk about what we dreamt about, right? We always ate breakfast together. So I told my mother and my brother about this dream, and then went on with my daily life. Well, you know, about later that afternoon, I'm listening to the rock and roll station, not KSL, right?
KCPX.
I'm like, oh, that's interesting. And so I rolled another joint and proceeded down the road. It's important. I was not anywhere near worthy at this time. And
I was on my way home, so I got home and I walked in the door. My mom's like, "Have you heard?" My mom was more religious than anyone else in the household. And I said, "Heard what?" And she's like, "Blacks have received the priesthood." And I said, "Well, that's interesting." And she said, "Well, don't you remember your dream?" "Oh, yeah."
Wow.
So, for some reason, I needed to see that.
Yeah, to give you some kind of, must have worked, got you back.
And my family, my grandmother family came from Mississippi. There was a lot of prejudice in my family.
Yeah.
And I had one black friend. But I mean, it was not.
I think it was going to take a revelation of this sort, because there was those feelings, especially in the South. And you could see in some ways it reflected among the brethren, but I think the cautionary tale for me then always is that these revelations can come. And I think part of it is the idea that in our own life, sometimes we need revelations and it doesn't necessarily come falling out of the sky. I just think the idea of having to reach on our tiptoes to seek out and search out, sometimes it takes a while to get that, and things have to shift a little bit sometimes in our life before we're ready to hear it or we're ready to implement the answer we're going to get. And so there's a pattern here that if you watch that President Kimball, I think, set for us. And any final comments on this before? Yeah. Yeah.
And the brethren, because of his leadership, because of what he was, if he was able to, the Spirit was able to convey this to the rest.
Yeah.
And just think, the Lord had a lot of faith in all of us. If we were going to do the right thing. And also, I think he had faith in the blacks who were so angry with him.
Yeah.
That they were going to have to. Forgiveness of us and all the things that are involved.
Yeah.
And it's started because
I know that Camilla Kimball, his wife, talks about the fact that on later that she found out, Camilla found out about the revelation the same time everybody else did. But she said he had been so weighed down and so heavy and so depressed, and some of his family members said he had been struggling for so long. Then they just watched it lift finally when it had been released. But she didn't know.
This is interesting to have this discussion. I think I'm the primary music leader finally. They use the word seek in the song.
Yeah.
It's not just look or gently wait around. You have to seek. And so we've been talking about this theme that there is work involved. And this is, you know, the work that he did, and now I'm seeing as President Nelson has been talking about, you can't just sit around and wait for it.
No.
And then I'm seeing these children and our own children and how this, even the primary songs are telling us that we have to
search and seek
if we want these answers.
Yep. All right. Well, last one.
In 1975, I was a candidate to the IWI meeting from representing. And we knew that there was a group from every state, but there was a group from Mississippi, and all my other members, no one was a member of the church. But it went around the whole convention to the conservatives that there was a woman from Mississippi that was a member of the church, who was also a member of the church.
Oh.
So now I'm going.
Wow. I know.
I wonder what happened.
I know. Okay, so yeah, let's go ahead and wrap up. I just think this is amazing stuff. And again, if you want to know anything more about this, I would really recommend that article, 1984, Edward Kimball, that has so much of this detail. And then the little book by Paul Reeve, Let's Talk About Race, is just, it's really good. And I think it's worth a read, so.
was this the time where we distinguished from that time forward, we distinguished more between doctrine and policy?
I think because if you think about even now, think about times when we talk about a variety of things, and we'll say, we go back to this, because that was the moment, this was such a watershed moment, because it's one where suddenly we looked at what we think is doctrine can change. How many times do we hear about a variety of things? We say, yeah, but in 1978, it can happen. So suddenly there was this, so I think we still get the reverberations from that moment outward. Anyway, bury my testimony. This is one of the more amazing events of in church history. Love it. And excited that it finally happened. And I leave that with you in Jesus' name. Amen. We're going to have a closing prayer. We want to feel moved. Okay, thanks.
And thank you for joining us for another Monday morning class. Hope you enjoyed it. If you have any suggestions about future topics that we could discuss, or if you had any questions concerning something that you heard in the class, please drop us a note. We'd love to hear from you. As always, if you happen to be in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, please come in and join us on a Monday morning. We'd love to see you and identify who you are. If the podcast itself is resonating with you, go ahead and click subscribe so that Apple can figure out where we are. We'd love to hear from you. So again, thank you for coming, and we'll see you for another Monday morning class.